Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program here on October 25th, 2012. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer, coming to you live as I do every Thursday at 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, we're going to have a very special guest, Dr. Paul Halpern, a professor of physics and fellow in the humanities at the University of Sciences in Philadelphia. We're going to be talking about galaxies and the universe. We've been pondering the universe lately here, what turns out to be Universe Month here this October for the Cycles of Change radio program. 2 weeks ago, we had Alan Steinfeld of New Realities TV on galactic cycles and their influence on human development. And last week, Ray Tomes, founder of the Cycles Research Institute, was here to discuss harmonics theory and patterns in the universe. Tonight, we're going to be talking about some of the wonderful books written by Dr. Halpern. I had the pleasure of meeting him just a few weeks ago as he gave a lecture here in Pennsylvania to discuss his latest work. And we're going to get into that and some of the other topics for us to talk about in universal theories, cycles, what it is about the observable universe, and what do we theorize beyond that. Paul Halpern is a professor of physics at the University of the Sciences and an acclaimed science writer, the author of 13 popular science books, most recently, Edge of the Universe, A Voyage to the Cosmic Horizon and Beyond. He's a recipient of the Fulbright Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and an Athenaeum Library Literary Award. Library Journal named his book, Collider, its physics selection for the best science books of 2009. He has appeared in numerous radio and television shows, including The Simpsons' 20th anniversary special. So we're going to bring him on and talk about some of the wonderful things about the universe in a language we can all understand, because he breaks it down for us. Dr. Halpern, are you there?
Yes. Hi, David. Thank you for having me on the Cycles of Change.
Oh, by all means. I so enjoyed your talk a while ago, and we all found it easy to understand everything that you were saying. But before we go off on any cyclical tangents, would you tell us a little bit about your new book, The Edge of the Universe?
Well, my new book focuses on some of the cutting-edge breakthroughs in 21st century cosmology. In the past, I wrote some historical books and looked a bit at the history of cosmology, the history of the universe. And I thought it was about time to do something that was very up-to-date, very current. And it's just been the last 10 years, 15 years have been a very exciting period for cosmology. There's been an enormous amount of change and a lot of new theories and a lot of new discoveries.
Well, and I like the way you approach it. Not only your most recent book, but one of your early works has captured my imagination, The Cyclical Serpent, where you start tying in some of the modern theories with a history of our looking at the universe. And it seems that, we have a serpent catching up and swallowing its own tail here as the future is meeting the past. We're catching up with some of the old ideas, are we not?
Yes, it's very interesting. The idea of cycles seems to pop up periodically. And in terms of philosophical and religious ideas, cycles is one of the earliest approaches to time. And that's just because so much of nature is in cycles. So much that we experience runs in a cycle. So it was only natural for the ancients, when they thought about time, to start thinking about time as a cycle.
Well, it does seem to be replete in nature with the day-night cycle and the lunar cycles and the yearly cycles. And we discovered the great cycle of some almost 26,000 years long, many, many years ago. But we've coming on now to examine our own linear thought, our modern-day thought, as we are starting to look at physical evidence of the universe. And maybe some of our models of imagination are proven to be outdated and new evidence. Do we see that?
Well, there's a debate going on in terms of whether or not the universe is linear versus cyclical. I think most cosmologists, to be honest, believe that time started with the Big Bang and that nothing came before the Big Bang. However, there's a growing group of cosmologists, notably Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turek and Roger Penrose, who've come up with separate proposals for what they call a big bounce in the first case and cyclic universe in the second case. ideas that something came before the Big Bang. And these ideas are very different from earlier ideas of cycles, because when you mention cycles to people who are somewhat familiar with cosmology, they think about something called the Big Crunch. And the Big Crunch would be kind of the Big Bang in reverse. But these newer ideas aren't really like the Big Bang in reverse. They're a different kind of renewal in which the universe keeps going the way it is, becomes more, runs down in terms of energy, becomes increasingly unusable in terms of its energy. Stars burn out, form black holes, or form dead stars, and then eventually the black holes radiate away until pretty much there's nothing left. And for someone who believes in a linear idea of time, that would be the end of the story. But then for somebody like Steinhardt and Turok or Roger Penrose, that's when a new cycle begins. And once everything is extinct, that's when another era happens.
Indeed. So is there the Big Bang, or just one of many recurring Big Bangs? Is there an inflationary expanding universe filled with self-iterating pockets of self-inflating realms? Are we living in a fractal holographic universe reflected in all things great and small? Did the ancients have it right in their myths and legends that describe the birth and death of cycles of the universe as something we see mirrored in nature in the circle of life?
Yes, it's really interesting. I mean, I like to see connections between philosophical and religious ideas and scientific ideas, not in terms of cause and effect, but in terms of sometimes some of the philosophical ideas serve as an interesting metaphor for what's going on right now. For example, Plato's idea of a cave where people are confined to the cave and they see shadows of some larger world is apt today, because a lot of physicists are talking about higher dimensions that we can't actually see, but we can only infer.
Through allegory.
Yes, so it's hard to imagine these things. For example, it's hard to imagine what lies beyond the observable universe. It's hard to imagine dimensions beyond the tangible physical dimensions, but a lot of theories talk about these things, and they're an important part of, for example, string theory talks about 10 or 11 dimensions, and of these dimensions, some of them might be curled up, and some of them might simply be inaccessible to our type of matter.
And there are people like Jean-Pierre Lumet who said that we might conceive of a dodecahedron as possibly a model for energies that we find in the universe as well. So there's a lot of schools of thought going on right now, aren't there?
Well, I haven't heard the dodecahedron. I've heard a few years ago somebody suggested a soccer ball shape, which would be a universe that somehow is closed in on itself and is somehow repetitive. And if you go in one direction, you end up coming back where you started. Of course, you couldn't possibly do that, but if hypothetically somebody could keep traveling in one direction, they would repeat their path. But evidence in the cosmic ripples left over from the Big Bang doesn't seem to support that right now, although scientists are still maintaining an open mind about whether or not the universe is closed. Most think that it's open and that you would just keep going forever.
So we have to take the little fragments of what we can find in the observable universe and leap beyond that with our imagination, which is basically what we've always done, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we do have these tools, and what some people think is that we need to look at what's out there in terms of experimental evidence and not really leap too far beyond that. But then there are theorists who say, well, you know, it's to complete the models, to try to, for example, to unite the forces of nature, you need to introduce new elements that we can't see, but maybe we'll eventually be able to detect. And that's why physicists are trying to detect things that there's no evidence for, but they're hoping to find evidence for, like, for example, higher dimensions and something called supersymmetry, which is an equation between the matter particles and the force fields in the universe, trying to say that there's a way of turning one into the other. And they're looking for these things, even though they haven't been found yet. And as you said, it's sometimes you have to be a little bit imaginative and sort of step beyond what is experimentally known.
And from the unmanifest comes the manifest. Your new book, Edge of the Universe, that's an intriguing title. I'd like to ask you, what do you mean by the edge of the universe? And what is the observable universe? And what is the center of the observable universe?
Well, that's interesting because the title, if we want it to be most accurate, the title should be Edge of the Observable Universe, because as mentioned, most scientists don't think that the actual universe has an edge. Most scientists today think that the actual universe keeps going forever, that it's infinite. Now, we can't prove that the actual universe is infinite, so we can only surmise by its geometry that it keeps going forever. The universe has what we call a flat geometry. Flat not meaning like a plane, but more like a box, something that's like a box that keeps going in all directions. And that's opposed to curved. In the past, some researchers thought that the universe could have been curved, but measurements have shown that straight lines will keep going as straight lines. So that's what most cosmologists think today, that the actual universe keeps going forever, kind of like an endless plane. Now, the observable universe is what part of the actual universe we can measure with telescopes, at least in theory. So it's not what we've already seen with telescopes, but what we could in principle measure with telescopes. So it's all the light we can collect from the beginning of when light was given off in the universe. So we try to see how far out we can go in terms of collecting light, and that's the observable universe. And that is something like 46 billion light years in radius. So it's kind of like a sphere, which has a radius of 46 billion light years. Now, light year is something like 6 trillion miles. So we're talking about an enormous amount. If you multiply 46 billion times 6 trillion, it's an incredible amount. It's boggling to think about something that's that huge. And that's just the observable universe. That's not the actual universe. We don't know how much of the actual universe is constituted by the observable universe.
My goodness. And as we try to figure out what might be out there, we have to conceive of abstract principles based on what we do see. And this is not unprecedented. I mean, long before we could circumnavigate the world with ships, there were those like Aristarchus who figured out the world was round, and there were people who stuck sticks in the ground and looked at the shadow at a certain time of day in one part of where they lived, and they would travel many miles away and watch the shadows on the stick the same part of time of the day and make a comparison and say, hey, the earth is bent. It must be a ball. And certainly nobody was walking all the way around the earth. And without walking around the earth, they figured it was round. And we figured that the sun is not going around us, we're going around it. So we're applying some of these observations and mathematics and reason, are we not, to come up with abstract principles that might hold true throughout the universe?
Yeah, what's really incredible is how tiny Earth is compared to the observable universe. And yet we can stand on this planet, this mere speck in a huge sea, and say that something about things that are so many trillions of miles away, billions of trillions of miles away, and make a statement about it. It's really amazing that we're able to do that. And that's because of the power of our instruments, things like the Hubble Space Telescope, which has proven enormously important in terms of being able to scope out the universe, and also something called the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, which is lesser known than the Hubble, but it's a satellite that was up in space in orbit for about 7 years, and it picked up signals from the early universe the hiss left over from the Big Bang that has cooled for many billions of years. And that's been instrumental in mapping out the history of the universe.
A great echo, is it not?
Yeah.
So, oh, my goodness. So we're using our minds to travel further than our feet or ships can take us. In this new work, The Edge of the Universe, what is it that you're bringing to us mostly? You have a wonderful way of putting bits of knowledge together and coming up with your own theories and educating us basically on where the state of the science is today and giving us an explanation that we can all grasp. So what is the main message of The Edge of the Universe?
Well, the message is, first of all, I start out by talking about the observable universe and what we know about it, and how certain aspects of the observable universe have become more precisely known, like, for instance, the age. Like, we can talk about the age since the Big Bang as being 13.75 billion years. That's a very precise number. If you talk to a cosmologist 20 years ago and you said, how old is the universe, they would fudge and say, well, somewhere between 9 billion and 15 billion, we're not exactly sure. And if you look at books from even the 90s, they'll talk about how we're really uncertain about the age of the universe. But remarkably, we now know how old the universe is from the Big Bang, and from the time of the Big Bang, and we also know the percentage of the universe that is visible matter versus things that are invisible, such as what is called dark matter and dark energy. Now, that said, we don't really know what these things called dark matter and dark energy really are. They're just these mysterious substances that, in the first case, dark matter, that causes gravitational clumping. That keeps galaxies together, that keeps clusters together. And if we don't have dark matter, then galaxies fall apart, galaxies clusters fall apart. And then the other thing is called dark energy, the other element, and that's what's causing the universe to speed up in its expansion, to accelerate. And those two elements, scientists are trying to discover what they are, but so far they haven't had any luck in finding out what these things are.
So we don't see it in themselves. Dark energy, dark matter is invisible, but we see it in what? Perturbations of light, just as, you know, well, we don't see the air. It's invisible, but we can see the billow of a sail. So how do we know that dark energy and dark matter might be there?
Well, dark matter was discovered a couple of times, actually. In the 1930s, someone named Fritz Zwicky, who was a Swiss astronomer, looked at clusters of galaxies. They were just starting to talk about clusters. And he estimated how much matter you would need, how much mass you would need to keep the clusters together. And then he measured how much mass there is in terms of the galaxies in the clusters. And he realized that you need a lot more mass to hold the clusters together, and a lot of the mass was missing. But Zwicky came up with a lot of controversial ideas, and people didn't really take it too seriously. But then in the 1960s and 1970s, an astronomer named Vera Rubin started to look at galaxies in our area, such as the Andromeda Galaxy and other nearby galaxies. And she looked at the outermost stars in those galaxies, the peripheral stars, and she estimated how much mass you would need to keep the stars moving at their current speeds. And she realized that a lot of the mass was missing there, too, that it was kind of like a carousel in which the outer horses are moving very quickly, but you don't see something pulling on them. You don't see a mechanism. You say, why are they moving so quickly? There's no machinery that's pulling them along. Well, the same thing with the outermost stars. There's nothing pulling them. There's not enough gravity pulling them if you just look at visible stars. So that's when people started to speculate about dark matter and saying, well, a lot of the galaxies are made of an invisible substance that we don't really know anything about. And dark energy has kind of a different story. That was discovered in 1998 by two teams of astronomers who were trying to figure out how much the galaxies in the universe were slowing down in their expansion rate. They knew about the Big Bang, And they figured that eventually the Big Bang would fizzle out because the Big Bang was kind of an initial burst, but eventually all bursts ran out of steam and that the galaxies would slow down in their expansion.
Yeah.
And maybe even come back to a point. That's the idea of the Big Crunch, if they would come back to a point. But they were completely baffled to find that the galaxies are speeding up in their expansion. It's almost like if you threw a ball up into the air, and instead of the ball coming down to the ground, the ball just kept going faster and faster and then left orbit.
Yeah.
You wouldn't expect that. You would think that the ball had some kind of extra engine in it or something like that. So that's what people think, is that there must be something extra, and that's the dark energy.
And we know that the more distant galaxies are speeding up because of the redshift of their light. Is that true?
Yes. There are two things that are used in tandem to show that the distant galaxies are speeding up. One is the redshift, which is an effect in which if things are moving away from us, their light shifts towards the red end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Things are moving toward us, that shifts towards the blue end, but we're seeing red shifts, which means that the galaxies are moving away. And then you can figure out their speed by the amount of the redshift. But then you can use another method, which is called the standard candle method, to figure out how far away the galaxies actually are. Standard candle is kind of like if you were in a dark hallway and you saw a candle, and if you knew how bright the candle was, you could figure out how far away it is, because
yes,
you could see, you could see it, you could see how dim or bright it looks. If you knew how much energy it's putting out, you could estimate how far away it is to put out the amount of energy to make it appear a certain way. So that's what they use, and the thing that they use as standard candles are supernovas with known power output. So these astronomers were charting supernova bursts. These happen randomly. They don't know when they will happen, but as soon as they could see a supernova burst, they could measure how much power it seemed to be putting out, compare it to a model of how much power it should be putting out, and that gave the astronomers information about the distances to the galaxies that the supernovas are in. And from those distances and the Doppler effect, the redshift, they could make a chart and figure out what's happening to the expansion rate of the universe. And
so we've got, distance and speed.
Right. Once you have distance and speed, you can make a chart to figure out how much faster things are getting or slower things are getting. And they were shocked to find out that things are getting faster and faster.
Weird. So we have dark matter, dark energy, and these comprise how much of the universe, possibly?
More than 95%, it's estimated.
Good Lord. I remember when I was a schoolboy learning that we are, maybe more than 99.99% space in our bodies. And this is everything is. And I'm going, what? Well, now we're looking at the universe and saying most of it is invisible.
Yes, that's right. Most of the, and that's not just the space in between, it's the substance. Most of the substance of the universe is invisible. So it's just incredible how little out there is actual atoms, the stuff that makes all of us. That's just a minority of what's out there.
Well, you're on the edge of scientific observation here, Dr. Halpern. And do you find that the different schools of thought that are sometimes at odds with each other may be coming closer together as we learn more?
Well, sometimes there's a convergence and sometimes there's a divergence. I think the recent discovery of the Higgs particle was an example of a convergence of thought, where people developed a model of particles that turned out to have experimental ramifications, and people were looking for those ramifications for decades, and finally the Higgs particle, which was the missing piece, was found and completing the model. So that was a very exciting way that scientists came together. But with dark matter and dark energy, there are a lot of different theories, and scientists hope to test these theories and try to distinguish among them. and see if they can narrow down the range of possibilities.
Well, I'm glad we have empirical thinkers such as yourself, who is also open to what else is being conceived and has been conceived throughout the ages. You know, you mentioned the Higgs particle. The press quoted that with the nickname the God particle. It's been getting quite a lot of buzz. You have a good knack for explaining things. Could you tell us a little bit about the Higgs particle, also known as the Higgs boson particle, is it?
That's right, yes. Well, Higgs is named after Peter Higgs, who was one of the people who came up with the mechanism. And boson means that's a kind of particle that has certain types of properties, and the properties relate to whether or not particles cluster together. Some particles like to cluster together, and some particles like to stay separate. And there's two types of clustering in nature, bosons and fermions. And fermions, which are the particles generally of matter, tend to like to stay in their own states. They don't like to be squeezed together too much. But bosons can be squeezed together as tightly as possible. You can have as many as you want in the same state. So that's the difference. And fermions are usually matter particles, and bosons are usually energy particles. The Higgs boson is a particular type of energy particle that it's thought to be the relic of a field known as the Higgs field, an energy field that existed in the very early universe, right after the Big Bang. And this energy field was something which initially was kind of random in terms of its movements. So you can imagine something like liquid water moving in different directions due to currents, just random currents.
Yeah.
And imagine a sea and you have water moving in all directions. Well, what would happen if the sea started cooling down enough? Eventually it would start to ice over. And if the sea started to ice over, I mean, usually oceans don't do this, but imagine an ice age, or imagine that you're close to the Arctic and the sea starts to ice over. Well, once the sea starts to ice over, then that gives you a preferred direction, because ships going through the sea can't go in every direction now. They can only go in particular directions, and it makes it harder for ships to move through. Well, think about this as an analogy for the particle world. Initially, the Higgs field was kind of like liquid water. It was moving in randomly, and other particles can move through that freely, just like through liquid water, ships find it very easy to move.
Mm-hmm.
But as the universe cooled down, the Higgs field froze in place in a particular direction. And once it froze in place, it made the other particles acquire a kind of bulk, and the other particles found it hard to move through, and they had to move through in particular directions, so it constrained their movements. And that gave the other particles what we call rest mass, which means that they now have bulk, they now have weight. And particles such as electrons, protons, and so forth, they always have mass. Even if they're not moving, they have mass. We know that because we can weigh them. And this mass came from the Higgs field, we think.
I see. And this created quite a stir in the scientific community, didn't it?
The discovery, yes, because the theory that was proposed of forces is called the Standard Model, the theory that explains three of the forces in nature, electricity and what's called the weak force, which causes radioactive decay, and what's called the strong force, which keeps nuclei together. Combining these into a single model, you have to assume that particles initially don't have mass. You assume that the particles are all massless and just move around freely at the speed of light. But then you need a mechanism to give them mass because, of course, the things around us, most of the particles have mass. So the mechanism is the Higgs mechanism, which is a kind of a phase change. And a phase change just means something like freezing. So Higgs proposed this idea that as the universe cooled, things would change and a kind of freezing would take place. and that would affect the other particles and give them mass. And one of the predictions was that there'd be a leftover part of the Higgs field, which is what we call the Higgs boson, and that's what they discovered.
You've got me really thinking here, Dr. Halpern. I mean, we're talking from the unmanifest to the manifest, from the invisible influencing the visible, from massless to developing mass, and we're discovering maybe one of the bridges in this last polarity here. I mean, are there some parallels going on here between that which is seemingly not and that which is? Vague question. I can be a little bit more vague if you like.
Okay. Could you
clarify that? Unless you prefer
that
abstract. I know you're a physicist.
Okay. Sounds like a philosophical question.
Well, you've broached some philosophical questions in The Cyclical Serpent, one of the other books I got when I came to hear you speak.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing how you tie in. You start talking out about the dance of Shiva and the different gods, and the Ouroboros, which is the symbol of the snake that swallows its own tail, and a cyclical motion, which was a symbol used for thousands of years in different continents. Talk about the cyclical universe, also known as the Kala Nemi. Kala comes from the ancient Sanskrit time. I use that in my work that I call Kala rhythms, which are the cycles of time that are replete throughout living organisms, our biorhythms, the changes of history in the world, the changes of trends in a nation. And time and time again, we keep finding that there may be universal patterns, whether we're looking at fractal geometry, whether we're looking at self-iterating cycles within cycles and so forth. Are we coming to some kind of a superstring theory? Are we really getting closer to the theory of everything, or are we diverging away from it in this last decade or so, Dr. Halpern?
Well, string theory is very interesting because a lot of scientists say that it's very beautiful mathematically, and it is nice because it's a finite theory, which means that if you look at the smallest things, instead of being dots, things are vibrating strings of energy. So that's what string theory is. It says that if you take a particle and if you could somehow hold a magnifying glass up to it and look at the very deepest level, it wouldn't look like a particle at all. It would look like a vibrating strand of energy. Well, the advantage of that is that a particle is infinitesimal, but a vibrating strand of energy has a small but finite size. And if you look at the mathematics of physical equations, a lot of them blow up to infinity if you talk about a infinitesimal length. If you divide by the length and the length is zero, then you get infinity. And the problem is, with older theories, that all these infinities popped up. But string theory is nice because it's mathematically sound. It's mathematically complete. And it predicts that the universe has 10 or 11 dimensions. And of these, a number of them, something like six, are curled up in a ball. In not exactly a ball, something like a pretzel shape. And it's called a Calabi-Yau manifold, which is a shape which reflects what kind of theory of nature you're talking about. If you have a different shape that the extra dimensions are twisted up into, you get a different theory of how forces interact with each other. But the problem is there are billions and billions and billions of these possible shapes. There's so many different possible shapes that it almost seems like there are billions of possible universes. And the question is, why does our universe have this particular bundle, this particular pretzel shape in the higher dimensions, which gives particular properties? And that's been a big question, and maybe a problem with string theory is that there's kind of an embarrassment of riches, that there's so many different possibilities that you can't really narrow it down to what we see around us. It's almost like you have billions and billions of possible universes. The question is, well, why are we in this particular universe and not in other possibilities? So it's really kind of a mystery.
It's fascinating. The six dimensions you talked about was the What was that word you used, Dr. Halpern, a collabifold?
Calabi-Yau manifold, named after the mathematicians who developed the idea. And it's just kind of like, if you imagine, it's hard to imagine six-dimensional thing, but imagine if you took a ball of string and you could tie it in many different ways, twist it in many different ways, and each way has its own topology, its own kind of shape. Yes. And each of these shapes gives you, if you work out the theory, a different set of equations that give you a different set of particles and a different set of energy fields.
Well, you've mentioned cycles in your study, and your latest book is not dependent on the theory of cycles at all, but as you've been looking at the universe, are you inclined to believe that there are abstract principles and that there may be such a thing as universal cycles replete throughout all of manifestation, or no?
Well, I mean, clearly, on some level, there are cycles, and you know, on many levels there are cycles, but the question is whether or not time, in the large sense, the time of the universe, is a cycle. And that, I think, is a mystery, and perhaps we'll someday find experimental evidence of universes that preceded ours. For example, Roger Penrose claimed, after he put out his cyclic universe theory, that there may be some evidence of scars left over from earlier cycles. And this was very much disputed by other astronomers. They didn't really see this in the evidence, but it could be that there would be some way of seeing signals of earlier cycles of the universe. I can't really think of a way right now, but it's, you know, hypothetically possible that there could be something left over from earlier cycles. But until there's evidence to the contrary, it's hard to imagine something before the Big Bang. It's you know, most cosmologists say, well, okay, it's something you can talk about. You can talk about earlier cycles, but the evidence is that the universe began in a Big Bang, that it was a point of infinite density, so nothing could go before it.
So a Big Bang, maybe there will be a crunch, maybe there'll be a bounce, maybe there'll be another Big Bang. There's questions of, are there brief memories of previous incarnations? And we have to consider in what is thought to be a relative universe, what is our concept of time? Time, of course, has been proven to be relative. And in the ancients, in Sanskrit, they talk about Kal, K-A-L-A, which is relative time and all the cycles within it. That's the time in which we live. But they also speak of Mahakala, which is transcendent time. And that is an absolute time beyond the relativity and the cyclical nature of all things that we know. In fact, Mahakala is one of the 108 names for Shiva. And it's a dance of Shiva that we believe is manifest in all the things that we can see and are moving. So we seem to, the ancients deified some of the observations that they had, and sometimes they had to go beyond what they could observe because they didn't have a Hubble telescope and some of the, you know, spacecrafts that we have going out there, that they seemed to go out in meditative states and be able to come up with things that they spoke in allegorical terms that only make sense to us now about when they're about to, you know, when we can see things and describe them in so many words and realize we're saying the same things sometimes.
Well, I think there's a lot of wisdom from the ancient world, particularly the Eastern world, about the impermanence of all things and how things are moving from one state to another. And I think in terms of human life, in terms of trying to enjoy life and focus on the here and now, I think that Buddhism, Hinduism, and a lot of the Eastern philosophies are really pertinent. I think that the whole idea scientifically of mindfulness, which is focusing on the present moment, is really very therapeutic and very helpful for people to think about, because if you worry all the time about you know, what's going to happen to the universe or what's going to happen to the Earth in the future and so forth, it's, you know, that's, it's not very productive. But if you can kind of embrace the idea that things go through cycles of change and that that things are impermanent, I think that's one way of dealing with nature and dealing with the world.
Well, we're certainly finding new ways to observe the manifest world around us and draw the parallels as we may. Folks, you're listening to the Cycles of Change radio program as we explore the universe with Dr. Paul Halpern, professor of physics here in Philadelphia. And since 1990, Dr. Halpern has written many, many books, starting with his first Time Journeys, going on the cosmic wormholes, the cyclical serpent, the structure of the universe, the pursuit of destiny, countdown to apocalypse, the quest for alien planets, faraway worlds, the great beyond, brave new universe, what science ever done for us, sounds like Homer Simpson right there, Collider, and his most recent Edge of the Universe. By the way, when I was there, I got to speak with some of the other people who came to hear you talk, and they not only talked, it was a couple who had read this new one, but many of them who had read your previous works and were there because of them, and they said they were very well written. And I have to go along with that. The writing style that you put together in your works makes it a very interesting read, hard to put down.
Oh, well, thank you. I like to think of metaphors. That's a fun part of writing for me, is thinking of ways to express things. I mean, the Higgs is a challenge for people to explain it, so the water and ice and ship analogy I kind of thought of as one way of explaining the Higgs, and I came up with another way of explaining it in previous books. So for each book, I try to come up with new metaphors, new ways of looking at things, because a lot of modern science is very hard to grasp unless you can use analogies, unless you can use metaphors.
Indeed. And Dr. Halpern, we have a caller on the line. I'd like to go to the phones here for just a minute. And caller from area code 949, you're here on the Cycles of Change radio program. Thank you for hanging on so patiently. Who may I ask is calling?
Yeah, this is Walter Cruttenden calling.
Walter Cruttenden of the Binary Research Institute in California?
That's right, yes. And I've been enjoying the talk immensely. Dr. Halpern, I just love his work and his willingness to explore some of these ideas, which I agree stretch the very edges of our philosophical thought. And so I wanted to ask Dr. Halpern, I can understand that the observable edge of the universe would exist because that's the edges of our capabilities, really. But it's difficult to imagine an actual edge of the universe. Can you just take us through a little thought experiment? And, you know, what if we could take a spaceship to the edge of the actual universe? What would it be like?
Well, I think current thinking is that the actual universe doesn't have an edge, that it goes on forever. But earlier ideas that the universe was curved, imagine the universe as being something like a beach ball, but expanded into a higher dimension. In which case, if you took a spaceship, if the universe was curved like a ball, if you took a spaceship and continued in one direction, you'd eventually reach your starting point. But then you'd say, well, then how can it have an edge? The edge would be in a higher dimension. It's kind of like if you were an ant walking around an orange, and the ant keeps going, it would never know that the orange has an edge, but if you looked at it from a distance, you would see the edge.
Yeah, but the concept of infinity, too, is for no edge of the universe is even harder to believe, if the universe is infinite, then everything has infinite possibilities, because there's infinite space and time for it to happen again and again. Is that more conceivable than a curved space?
Well, if the universe is infinite, you're right that if the universe has a finite number of possibilities but an infinite amount of space, eventually things will repeat themselves. So you could have other Earths. You could have places which are like Earth but maybe with slight difference. So That's why with the elections coming up, no matter who you support, you should take heart that perhaps in another version of Earth, whoever you support will win. So it's, you know, there could be places where any celebrity of your choice would be president. So
that's a great thought. And just one last question, if I might. You mentioned the sort of the freeze concept to the Higgs field, which I think is a great way to sort of visualize this. And yet it seems to be at odds with this idea of dark energy. If the universe is not only expanding but speeding up, it doesn't seem like a freezing universe. If anything, it seems like a thawing universe.
Well, the freezing is an analogy. I mean, the freezing is from the original hot state. So the Big Bang was extremely hot, you know, and then as the universe cooled, the freezing is going from extremely hot to slightly less hot. But now the universe has a temperature. The temperature has been measured, and it's about 3 degrees above absolute zero. So it's interesting. Space is not absolute zero. Space is about 2.73 degrees, or you can round it to 3 degrees above absolute zero. And the temperature of space is getting cooler and cooler, and as the universe expands, it's getting closer and closer to absolute zero. The universe can never get to absolute zero because that's an unreachable amount.
My goodness.
Fascinating work. Fascinating. Thank you for taking my questions. I'll continue to follow it offline here.
Oh, sure. Great talking to you.
That was Walter Cruttenden of BinaryResearchInstitute.org. Walter was on the show a couple of months ago, and he was discussing the concept that our star might be part of a binary star system, but that the second star orbiting ours would have an irregular, very long elliptical orbit, and something that we would only be able to see so many thousands of years. Now, Dr. Halpern, is it true that when you look at the stars out in the universe, that perhaps the majority of stars that are out there are part of binary or even trinary systems orbiting each other?
Yes. It's amazing how many, you know, how many systems are binary star systems, and it's, you know, it's, I don't believe that our own sun is a binary star, but there are many binary stars out there, and there can even be planets around binary star systems. And I read recently that there's even a case where they found a planet with four stars in the system.
My goodness. Yeah, and there really isn't anything that spectacular or unusual about our solar system, is there? I mean, we used to see ourselves as the center of the universe, and now we're finding that we're just on an arm of a galaxy and not necessarily that spectacular of a galaxy, and on and on and on.
Yes, I mean, used to be, I mean, when I was little, our solar system was unique, and now it's amazing that I go and delve into this in my book, The Quest for Alien Planets. They found so many planets around other star systems, and much more than when I wrote the book. So it's really exciting, but kind of humbling to think about, you know, how ununique we are.
Well, yeah, and we have a lot to learn right at home in our own solar system, and there's still a lot of things that yet to be seen, and that we haven't seen. Pluto was a planet, and it got demoted. What is a planet? What is a planetoid? Part of the Kuiper Belt. It isn't even the largest body out there. We didn't know all of that. So we might have been for some great surprises on what we're going to find here. And every decade, we seem to throw out some of the books from the decade before. But that's what makes it so exciting about always learning something new.
Oh, yeah. Well, cosmology and astronomy in general, they're both very exciting fields, and they're full of change. And I would strongly encourage you know, young people who are interested in science to get involved in those fields.
Well, Dr. Halpern, what about the speed of light? I mean, we certainly don't see anything moving faster than the speed of light, but if it was moving faster than the speed of light, we wouldn't see it anyway. Well, little pun there, a little joke. But what about the expansion of the universe? What about the space in which the universe expanded before all of this and the cycles we might observe took place? How did that come about?
Well, the universe isn't really expanding into a space. Its space itself is expanding, which is strange to think about. I mean, people say, what's the universe expanding into? Well, it's just that space is getting bigger. So it's not that there's another space out there, but it's interesting to think about that. And
we have to think what we mean by space itself. It's not what it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's used to be that before Einstein, people thought of space as just kind of a flat stage in which the drama of particles is acted out. But now we know that the stage itself is dynamic, that it's part of the action. Space itself is part of the action. So it's kind of weird to think about that space itself can change over time. And that's what Einstein's general theory of relativity states. But in terms of the question of traveling faster than the speed of light, well, Einstein's special theory of relativity says that particles can't travel faster than the speed of light. But the general theory says nothing about space, whether or not space can expand faster than the speed of light. It doesn't prohibit space from expanding faster than the speed of light. So we believe that relative to us, eventually, other parts of space will be moving away from us faster than the speed of light because the expansion of the universe is getting faster and faster and nothing is stopping it.
Good heavens. Do you believe that we might be able to navigate through wormholes? I mean, I'm a great fan of science fiction, and that's certainly one way. How did wormholes get their name?
Well, they were named by a great physicist who I had the pleasure of meeting about 10 years ago, John Wheeler. Mm. John Wheeler was great in coming up with colorful names for things, an American physicist. And he was the one who coined the name black holes. And
yes.
He thought of wormholes because he imagined an apple and imagined a worm sort of inching its way through an apple and creating a shortcut between two different parts of the apple. And that's how he came up with the name wormhole.
So space can curve back on itself. We can shortcut linear travel. So once again, we're getting away from linear thought, linear travel, linear models. The mechanical universe of Newton breaks down when you get down to the subatomic level.
Mm-hmm.
So are we going to find transcendent principles? Are we going to have different layers of the universe? Are we in a manifest parfait? You can use the laws of Newton when you're looking at the stars, but not use them when you're looking at quantum physics. I mean, what will be the universality of all of this in the end? Who knows?
Well, I think people want to combine the two very successful theories of the 20th century, quantum physics and general relativity, into one theory, and that would be called quantum gravity. And
yes,
people have been trying to do that really since the 20s and 30s, trying to combine these things, but with not much success. And that's where string theory comes in, because people think that string theory might be a way of combining quantum theory with gravity. But the problem is, as mentioned, there's so many different types of string theory that people haven't been able to find a way of narrowing it down and saying, well, this is the reason the universe is the way it is.
We have a little further to go, but it sounds like we're getting closer to the infinite edge. That's like kind of approaching the horizon here on Earth. There's always going to be a horizon, but you can always keep going further.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
Well, I think your works take us a little bit further. I've certainly enjoyed reading them, and your talk was very good. You handled questions very well. When people would raise their hand and they would ask a question, you weren't talking over our heads. I've always thought that was a sign of somebody who really understands what they're talking about, is that they can explain it to somebody else.
Well, it's because I wear a couple different hats, because I teach classes and I try to put things in terms that students can understand. And then You know, when I write, I try to put things in terms of what non-specialists can understand. So I think it's really important. I think nowadays there's so much change in terms of science that I think being able to explain it and understand it is really important. I think scientific literacy is really incredibly important these days.
It certainly is. How long have you been teaching, Dr. Halperin?
Close to 25 years.
My goodness, almost a quarter of a century. Have you noticed a difference in your students, say the students of today, as compared to a decade ago and a decade before that?
Well, sometimes I talk to students and I think, well, students are students. They're into similar things. I think what's changed is, and this could be a whole different discussion, technology has really changed. So I unfortunately don't see as many students walking around with books and you know, saying, I really want to talk about ideas and discussion groups and so forth, which when I was a student, everybody was, you know, interested in discussing ideas and getting together to debate ideas. I'd like to see a little more of that. But on the other hand, students today are interconnected in ways unimaginable 25 years ago. They're you know, connected through social networks and you know, connected nationally and internationally with all different kinds of networks. So that's kind of exciting. It's just different from what was going on a quarter of a century ago.
As what we're learning is changing and how we're learning is changing, we're seeing education take on new methods. Well, what do students want today compared to what they wanted in decades before? Is what the student is looking for in education and what they want to do with their minds the same, or has that been changing too?
Well, I find a lot of students still find same things kind of cool, like you know, study of the universe seems to appeal to a lot of students. And I remember when I was young, I met Isaac Asimov and being being really amazed by his visions of space and so forth. He was, you know, one of my heroes growing up, and you know, hearing him give a talk. And I think today, you know, if a science writer or, you know, science fiction writer gave a talk, they probably meet very similar children, you know, interested in what they have to say and amazed by the immensity of the universe and all the possibilities.
Well, hopefully there's nothing new under the sun as far as that's concerned, and that inquisitive minds will continue to reach on and as we reach out into the universe. Do you see us going to Mars here in our own lifetime, actually putting a person on the planet?
Well, when I was little, they talked about you know, going to Mars within a couple of decades, and I was sort of bracing myself for it. And then it ended up being robotic missions rather than human missions. I think there are still a lot of barriers to human travel to Mars. From what I understand, you know, the spaceships and suits and so forth would have to be really shielded against intense amounts of radiation. Mm. If you have a solar flare, you could have you know, radiation, you know, going through the ship, and unless there's a lot of shielding, it could really, you know, injure the astronauts. And also, you'd be talking about very, very long periods of time in space, and that has a lot of effects on astronauts in terms of their, you know, in terms of their muscles and their health, and sleep and so forth. There's all these biological effects of being out in space that would have to be dealt with before we can go to Mars.
I'm sure there are a lot of obstacles, and we're continuing to understand more and more what we have to do. I'm just old enough to remember as a boy how trips to the moon were science fiction. I used to read about it in comic books and books. There were no satellites. We had not taken to orbit yet, and then I saw, you know, John Glenn take to orbit, and remember when the Russians put Sputnik up, and that was a big to-do. We've got a long, long way to go, but we keep on learning, we keep on moving, and we're rediscovering old truths and busting old myths and learning new things about the universe around us. and all things in nature in the process, because it seems when you learn anything about something, you're learning something about it all. Blake spoke of seeing the entire universe in a single grain of sand. Dr. Paul Halpern and his latest book, The Edge of the Universe. Thank you for joining us tonight and giving us some elucidation on the universe and beyond.
My pleasure. It's great talking to you, David.
Thank you all for listening to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, signing out tonight. Join us again next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Good night.